Hi, my name is Jeff Redding. I'm a preaching elder here at Walton Community Church in Monroe, Georgia. Before we begin the sermon, our church would like to invite you to join us as we gather every Sunday morning for worship at 10 a.m. You can learn more about our church on our website at waltoncommunitychurch.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, Walton Community Church. I'm up here. Let's go ahead and open to Leviticus. We're going to be in chapter 20 today. Next week, Lord willing, we'll do chapter 21, maybe 21 and 22 at the same time. In this passage, we have the closing of a section, and it's going to be calling the people to be holy. This is incredibly important for people, for the people of God, as they are becoming a nation, as they are to enter into the promised land of God. They are to be what God desires for them to be, what He is creating them to be. So we're going to be looking at that. Guys, do you have the first slide by any chance? All right, so I've talked about chiasms before, and this is just a quick outline of the book. Just to kind of be a big refresher, we see repeating parts. Chapters 1 through 7 and 23 and 25 deal with worship. Chapters 8 through 10 and 21 through 22 deals with the priests. 11 through 15 and 17 through 20, they are to be a holy people. And I believe the center of this book really boils down to chapter 16, the Day of Atonement, how they are to be clean before God and in His sanctuary. So we're going to be closing on holy people, and next week we're going to be looking again how the priests are to be clean internally and externally as they serve the Lord. So as we come to Leviticus 20, we find that this is a very heavy chapter. And there's been difficult passages, difficult sections for us to review and to look at. Some of the content that is discussed is stuff we don't talk about at the dinner table. Some of the cultural things that they lived in, we are so far removed from today. How they think about diet, how they think about health, how they think about what they wear, how they exchange trade. These things are completely foreign to us, let alone worship. The way in which we worship in the New Testament is far different because Christ's blood has been shed on our behalf. In verses 1 through 6, God is going to be giving directions to Israel. Do not imitate pagan worship. So that's 1 through 6, pagan worship. And then we're going to see later on, don't be engaged in pagan practice at home. So I'm going to read verses 1 through 5, and then we'll go to 6, another form of pagan worship. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Say to the people of Israel, any one of the people of Israel or the strangers who sojourn in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people, because he has given one of his children to Molech to make my sanctuary unclean and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do not at all close their eyes to that man when he gives one of his children to Molech and do not put him to death, then I will set my face against that man and against his clan and will cut them off from among their people, him and all who follow him in whoring after Molech." We've already seen this practice, this worship of Molech, addressed in 1821. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. So you have that image of your mind of what the Lord is forbidding for them to do in this worship. Verse 2 of 20 says, "The people of the land shall stone him with stones." So why are they to stone an individual that sacrifices their child to worship? Well, you can think of a lot of reasons why you would be motivated to do so. The first and foremost reason is because it pollutes and defiles the name of Yahweh. Who God is at stake with their treatment of their children. Who God is at stake in the way they approach worship. The consequence of this sin and others results in stoning by a community, and there is no atonement for this sin. So young adults, those who are developing in their theology, you will hear an argument: stealing a candy bar is just as bad as a sin as murdering someone. No, it is not. And you don't truly believe that either. One sin is just as equal as the other. Our culture honestly does not even believe that. I will speak generally, but I want to paint a picture in your mind. There are some words that if I speak them in any context, I will be permanently canceled. If there's any type of isolation or mishandling of a gender or a specific group, our culture that we live in will not forgive me. I mean, there are some just one word words that if I say once to describe someone else, I would be fired. So sins don't carry the same equal weight in the world. And this one of offering one's child to Molech, there is no atonement for that sin. The only appropriate response to this is death. Now we will find different weights within this chapter and different forms of execution. I want you to know, though, in the backdrop of this very serious chapter, this speaks of the ultimate extent of the law. So we know many men and women in the Old Testament and in the New Testament who commit some of these sins, and they're not stoned, they're not burned alive, God doesn't strike them down with thunder and consume them. But the Lord is pronouncing here, this is the greatest extent, this is the heaviest verdict that can be passed down. And this is far different from the laws of the day in Israel's time. So if someone in the camp commits a grievous sin, their whole family is not killed. Only those who engaged in rebellion and in this commitment. That is far different from the ancient times. Guilty by association, you too could be robbed or have possessions taken away from you or slaughtered. Now what we do see is Yahweh does say, if the people turned a blind eye to this, well then the Lord would judge them because that is a sin. But if my sister or my neighbor or my mother and father did something and I was detached from it, God's law protected me. I am an innocent bystander in this. But I am to enact justice. God requires this execution, stated here, by the congregation. This is to affirm their solidarity in response to pagan worship. Commonly, this execution took place outside of the camp, and we see places of this form of execution even in the New Testament. Acts 7:56-8, Stephen is cast out of the city gates, and he is stoned because he is righteous, because he's giving an account of what Christ has done, because he's exposing sin. But the people interpret him as a blasphemer, and for blaspheming, one of the consequences could be death, the highest extent of it. Paul and Barnabas also face this same type of treatment and almost lose their lives in Iconium for preaching the gospel, Acts 14:5. This was a common practice in their day. Now, Walton Community Church, we're not Israel, are we? We engage discipline far different from them in the Old Testament. And we'll get to that in a moment. But first, I want you to think, if you are in the community of God, one of the accountabilities pressed upon you is when grievous rebellion happens among the people, you are to assist in execution. I know your faces. I know most of your stories. Some of them I know very well. Some of you know my kitchen. Some of you know the messiness of our van. And the idea of knowing someone that well and having to enforce this execution is terrifying. There's no joy in that. We have this beautiful community of people here. Can you imagine going back to this violent law? I didn't say this law is wicked. I said it's violent. Heartbreaking to grieve that. The reason why this is placed on them is for several reasons. One, they didn't have a prison. There was no jail. There was no rehabilitation center. They're in the wilderness, and the Lord wanted to confront this head on. That's one reason. A second reason is for them righteousness, sin. So the world will look at different sins and different life choices and different worldviews, and they will tell us to lighten up. And there are times where we do need to lighten up. There are some gray areas, okay? But then there are areas that are black and white. And we are to take serious sin, and we are to hate it. But in this, remember, God is the judge. In New Testament church, we will get into it in a moment, a little later on in the sermon, what we are to do. So verse 3, I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off. In this point, I want to say God actively, not passively, sets his face against those who desecrate his sanctuary and profane his name. God actively judges. God is never in a position of saying, well, this is just, I don't know what else to do. This is all I can do. You press me back into a corner. God does not allow himself to be cornered. God does not ask himself, well, what do I do next? God doesn't say, well, I can't help it. God says against this individual, there will be grace in this sermon, I promise you. But God actively says he will cut this person off. This isn't the only passage where God shows himself to be fierce. Psalms 106, 37 through 42. The psalmist writes, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to the demons. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. Thus they became unclean by their acts and played the whore in their deeds. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he abhorred his heritage. He gave them into the land of the nations, so that those who hated them ruled over them. Their enemies oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their power. One of my favorite books of the Bible, don't ask me why, Nahum. Nahum chapter 1, verse 2. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. The Lord says he is avenging 3 times in that one verse. This is my name. This is who I am. God is active in punishment. Now, this is written to the Assyrians, not to the covenant people of the Lord. We need to understand that in the backdrop. He says later in verse 8 of Nahum 1, that God will pursue his enemies into darkness. His judgments do not end here. The way in which we avenge, the way in which we seek justice and to make things right, is very limited. If an individual takes four lives, we can only take their one. But in darkness, God visits the evil one, his enemy, with his wrath. We don't take joy in this, but we see this as serious. Sin is something that is serious. Sin is so serious, the second member of the Godhead came on earth to remove the consequences of our sin so that we may eternally live with God in paradise and dwell with him. We see in verse 6, spiritual prostitution. If a person turns to mediums and necromancers, whoring after them, and you got to just notice the language here, the sexual implications here, to be faithful to the Lord. I'll continue. I will set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. Keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So these verses speak to those who seek protection from wandering spirits or believe in the provisions of relatives or mighty warriors that have passed before them, hoping to find greater results, greater power, greater protection than what God can provide. And I can say that I, though I don't seek mediums or necromancers or ghosts, I am prone to believing other things can deliver me far better, far quicker, more fair, more lovely than the Lord can. And that is to lie to myself, and that is to have allegiance to another bridegroom. So I want to encourage you, do not bind your heart to something else, thinking that it delivers you far greater than the Lord. Say, yeah, but I am on a time frame. I understand the time frame. No, but I need it now, or this is really intense, or I went outside of God's boundaries. He's not going to bless me. Can that God, can that being, can that thing truly deliver you? No. Now, cutting off, I don't like it when things, sometimes I love ambiguity. Here, I don't like the ambiguity. Cut off, this can mean either, and it means several things in several different contexts, so I don't know how to apply cut off here. It can either mean these people are placed outside of Israel. It can also mean the Lord directly executes his judgment on him. Remember Nadab and Abihu? How they offered strange fire? As they were installed and inaugurated as priests before the Lord to perform beautiful duties, to allow the people to have access to the Lord in a new and beautiful and faithful way. And on that day of them being inaugurated, they offer strange fire, and the Lord strikes them dead. Among all the celebration, among all the filled hopes, this scene happens. Whatever cut off means, the Lord is intentional and personal in doing so. So this chapter mentions three forms of punishment. Death, usually by stoning, sometimes burning, being cut off, and also childlessness. This was seen as a curse. So the majority of sins listed here are deliberate, rebellious, intentional violations of the Lord. This isn't an accidental sin. This isn't a minor offense. This is one setting their nose against the Lord. How more against the Lord can you be to take an innocent life he has given you that has your eyes or your wife's eyes, your nose or your wife's nose, maybe even has grandma's ears, and to take that thing and to consume it with fire? What fear has to dwell inside of a person to commit such an atrocious thing? And beloved, we are capable of doing so, and Israel did engage in that fear. Give your fear and anxiety to the Lord. Trust in his salvation to come with Christ, and in his salvation now. You are known, you are loved, you are cared for. It does not mean you are not in a trial. It does not mean that things are extremely difficult and you feel like you are running blind. But comfort yourself in him. So verses 9 through 21 are instructions on building a holy home. The beginning dealt with keeping God's kingdom and his land holy, keeping his name holy. And now as individuals think of keeping their name and their home holy, there are instructions for them. Verse 9, honoring father and mother. For anyone who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother. His blood is upon him. So, little kiddos, you hear that, especially you use that wiggle and have to color right now and fight. You disobey us, we'll kill you. That's a joke. I'm going to listen to that again on YouTube just so I can enjoy that. This is the highest extent of the law, and this is not for a child. Deuteronomy gives further instructions on this. This is for an adult who seeks to be a curse to their parents. They are constantly against them. They are not a support. They are a burden. They are not a blessing. They are a curse. And the law says the greatest punishment that can be given to such a child, such an adult, is their life being taken away. We do not see this verse mentioned, to my mind, anywhere in the Bible. Now we can see where the Lord has punished someone's child and taken their life, but we don't have anywhere, to my knowledge, where the elders are consulted and someone's adult son is brought forward and their life is taken. If you can think of an idea or an example, I'm always at the playground. So now we have in verse 10 through 21, restraints on sexuality. So I'm going to read this. This is quite a bit of verses in this section, and I'll do some bullet points here. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. If a man lies with his father's wife, he has uncovered his father's nakedness. Both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. If a man lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They have committed perversion. Their blood is upon them. If a man lies with a male, as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. If a man takes a woman and her mother also, it is depravity. He and they shall be burned with fire, that there may be no depravity among them. If a man lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall kill the animal. If a woman approaches any animal and lies with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. If a man takes his sister, a daughter of his father, or a daughter of his mother, and sees her nakedness, and she sees his nakedness, it is a disgrace, and they shall be cut off in the sight of the children of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness, and she shall bear his iniquity. If a man lies with a woman during her menstrual period and uncovers her nakedness, he has made naked her fountain, and she has uncovered the fountain of her blood. Both of them shall be cut off from among their people. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister or your father's sister. For that is to make nakedness one's relative. They shall bear their iniquity. If a man lies with his uncle's wife, he has uncovered his uncle's nakedness. They shall bear their sins. They shall die childless. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. So we see that adultery, the highest punishment for it, can be death. Incest as well, death. Homosexuality, death. Bestiality, death to man and to beast, or woman and beast. These deaths usually are done through stoning. Married to a woman and her mother, mentioned verse 14, for some odd reason, this is singled out for death by fire. And then there are other forms of incest mentioned, and the consequence of that is they are to be childless. Their name is not to continue forward in this. So we've visited some of the sexual sins beforehand. There are children here, and this is very common with very little deviation. So instead of exegeting what every word means, which is very clear as day of its meaning in the English, I want to ask some questions. Question one, what do we say to our brothers and sisters that want to adopt the culture of the law and Judaism? One of the big motivations to preaching from this book is there are those that are very zealous and following after the Lord, and then in so doing, they want to become more Jewish. So they might change their wardrobe, which is fine. They might observe some feasts or holidays, which is fine, but we usually do that in our ignorance. And they want to proselytize us and say, to be faithful to the Lord, you have to say the law is good and follow it to this absurd standard. Well, what about the laws here? How do we apply the law if a loved one we know expresses sexuality in a way that is not allowed but forbidden under God's law? How are we as a faithful people of the Lord to place judgment on those that are disobedient? At our last elders meeting, I confess, we neglected to talk about members we should stone. That is a joke. You need to laugh at that, okay? That's never going to happen in an elders meeting. I'm a southpaw and I didn't do athletics anyway. You'd be safe with me. But we don't talk about, well, who do we need to kill and get rid of? There are restrictions for that. So recognize the restrictions. We are now, the church is of peoples, of nations, not of one ethnicity, which means we now submit to governments that the Lord has established. And because we have these governments that the Lord has established, we submit to them and their rulings and dealings. That's a blessing that God has given. So, beloved, we don't have to be the judge in some respects. Another question, how are we influenced by our culture? So burning or cutting open your infant is grotesque, but humanity has been guilty of it. The perversity that is mentioned in the sexual restraints, 10 through 21, is gross and is distorted, but humanity has engaged with it. I want to ask the question, how do we face our fears? Because they rise within us. The world situation says, burn the flesh of your children, then you will be free. Then you will satisfy your inner fears. Now let's recognize that's wicked, and also recognize how some might find comfort in that. A child means things are going to radically change. A child means I have to let go of some hopes and dreams. A child coming reveals what I have done. How do we feed our desires? When we indulge in our lusts, when we seek to intoxicate ourselves, we remove ourselves from all restraints and we become beasts ourselves. It's my body. It's my choice. This is my understanding of love and expressing it and giving it and receiving love from others. But this defiles us. Beloved, the Lord wants you to come to him with his fears. We have a mighty God that does not say, listen, I know you have a lot of problems, but you're freaking me out right now. I'm not answering phone calls at the moment, or take your toxicity somewhere else because they only want positive people on their prayer mats praying to me. That's not our God. Our God pursues toxic people and says, I can carry that burden. Put me to the test. I can carry that burden. I can place that weight on my back. You can follow me and I will walk with you through this trial. To your desires, how often are we left wanting? When pursuing something that is good or something that is wicked, how often are we left at the end of seeking to satisfy our hunger and we think, man, what is next? That's a common illustration about Christmas. Doesn't matter even your age. All the presents have been opened, all the things have been shared and exchanged, and you're either wishing for a better present or wishing someone was there or that the coffee was warm, not cold, or the meal showed up on time. You're always left wanting even on those great festive days. Do not think that what the world offers you to feed your desires will feed you, but you will become beastly in it. God exhorts his people to pursue him, to have your fears met with assurance. Question 3. How are we to restore one another? How are we to restore one another? Because we're not all saints all the time. And you know what I mean by that. We are all saved, and I don't believe one loses one's salvation. God doesn't change his mind. He's immutable. He does not change. But how do we restore one another in our shortcomings? Galatians 6:1. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. James 5:19-20. My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. Another question I want to ask, how are we to receive correction? What happens when we are the one that offends God, when we offend our neighbor, and we have trespassed? Before I even answer that question, when we commit things like an offense, a trespass, rebellion, not an accident, a weakness, an oversight. But when we intentionally fix our nose against the Lord, what's our response? Psalms 141, verse 5. Let a righteous man strike me. It is a kindness. Let him rebuke me. It is oil for my head. Let my head not refuse it. Now, in that example, that is a bit pronounced. Not everyone says, hit me hard with that rebuke, will you? Just one more time on the cheek. He's not saying, The psalmist isn't saying, be ridiculous, be a sadist, someone that just really enjoys being crushed and annihilated. But recognize that reproof is for your good. It is an anointment to your soul. It is kindness. Have you ever been rebuked and it just felt good? I mean, it shook you to the core. You felt cold. You got goosebumps. You started sweating. But haven't you seen immediate benefit? Ever been in that experience? And if not, beloved, I hope that we get to love you in that way. Not that we enjoy ruining your day. We enjoy extending grace and showing love. But it's beautiful when someone is able to point out the log in our eye and say, brother, sister, it's a log. We want to come beside you and help you in this time. Now we have another section for them to be holy, verses 22 through 27. In this section, particular attention is given to the relationship of Israel's obedience to the occupation of the land of Canaan. You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my rules and do them, that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. And you shall not walk in the customs of the nation that I am driving out before you. For they did all these things, and therefore I detested them. But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you a possession, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the peoples. You shall therefore separate the clean beast from the unclean, and the unclean bird from the clean. And you shall not make yourself detestable by beast or by bird or by anything with which the ground crawls, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy and have separated you from the peoples, that you should be mine. A man or a woman who is a medium or a necromancer shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood shall be. Do you guys have that second slide by any chance? So what sounds really odd is verse 27 seems to be really out of place here. He's telling them to be holy, but I think this whole chapter is following this chiasm real quick. They are to abstain from pagan practices. That's point A. Point B, they are to be holy. C, they are to obey the Lord. Being holy requires obedience. D, the punishment for sins against other people here. You can go ahead and take that down. If you want it, I can email it to you or something like that. It's not inspired. So now there is this call for them to be holy. All of this intent behind it is for them to be holy. He mentions a little bit about how they are to treat their dietary system. He mentions again that they are not to practice pagan worship. How are they to do this? Israel comes from the influence of Egypt, a very strong kingdom, a very pagan and wicked kingdom. They're going to be going into lands that look a lot like the Egyptians. They're powerful. They're already a. Maybe it's a certain practices and things that they do that make them successful. Have you ever considered compromising your morals, your standards, your way of life? Because someone else was really successful and really happy and had it cush? The nation was not to do so. God's people, however, are only able to follow him by his grace, because he has made them holy. They have been made his. He has possession of them, and he has declared them to be separate, to be other, to be holy. Beloved, you are holy because God has called you, those who bend the knee to Christ. Like I've said a billion times now, it's not because of your spiritual resume, but it's because of God's grace and God's doing. Philippians 2:13 says, it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. You want to make the Lord pleased? You want to delight in the Lord? Have Him work within you. Place your fears before Him. Find your joy in Him. Submit to Him and live a radical life that is holy, that is completely other than our culture, but is filled with wonder and with awe. So an application I want to leave. Christian, you're not to live and look like the world. You belong to God, not your employer, not your generation, your government or political party. You can be involved in those things, but you do not belong solely to them. You have a heavenly Father. You have spiritual siblings. And it is your joy and your will to follow Him. Your fears, your doubts, your worries, your anxiety are brought to God, and He will care for you. Let's bow in prayer. True and living God, remind us that the borders You place around our lives are for our good, that they lead to righteousness, that they lead to flourishing, that in them there is joy and assurance. We come to hard passages like Leviticus, and we are reminded of the seriousness of our sin. May we grieve our sin, Father. May we hate it. But may we also remind ourselves, You have provided a way for us to receive forgiveness. And may we not take that for granted. May we not take light that salvation is offered today for those who are still in rebellion. And may we not belittle Your grace and Your power, that You have overcome death, that You have paid the wages of sin, and that a sure and steady salvation that does not change with history, with culture, and with trends, but a steady and strong salvation is available for all. We thank You for Your grace. It's in Your Son's name we pray. Amen.